You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Not too many times I'm going to be able to say that anymore, is it, Don? Don't we have weather coming up with rain?
Well, you're going to be able to say it off and on for the next week. We are recording this program on October 30, 2024, for broadcast on Halloween, October 31st, 2024. As a parent, I can tell you that it almost always rains on Halloween. It's been very traditional here in the Sacramento Valley. And guess what the weather forecast is for Halloween? Thursday, chance of showers, 64 degrees. Thursday night, so going into the evening, slight chance of showers, 20%. So, you know, carry an umbrella for your little trick-or-treaters. And it'll be 43 degrees. So let's look at the weather for the next week and talk a little bit about where we've come in the last 3 weeks. Thursday, high will be 64. As I mentioned, chance of showers. Thursday night, 43 degrees, 20% or slight chance of showers. I should note, a little storm passed over us over the last couple of days, and the UC Berkeley Snow Lab, which is not at UC Berkeley, it's up near Donner Pass, recorded half an inch to an inch of snow. So a little bit of snow has fallen at the very, very, very highest elevation. There was a little bit of rain around the area, as I like to say, enough to coagulate the dust off of the leaves of the tree over my truck and drop that dust onto my windshield. Friday, the high will be 64 degrees, slight chance of showers. Friday night, 49 degrees and showers. Showers are likely Saturday with a high of 61 degrees. Saturday night, 45 degrees, slight chance of showers and clearing up. Sunday is going to be sunny, 65 degrees. Monday is going to be sunny, 67 degrees. Tuesday is going to be mostly sunny, 67 degrees. But these night temperatures are what we're looking at, with a low of 42 on Monday night. And the low this morning here, in at least in our area, was 40 degrees. So we were just chatting before we started this, you know, how quickly did we drop in the month of October from summer to feeling like winter? On October 8th, it was 100 degrees. And yesterday, October 29th, it was 69 degrees. And the night low,
3 weeks.
And the night low temperature was 40. So we went from 100 degrees to 40 degrees in less than 3 weeks. Yeah, perfect planting weather. Perfect weather for dividing perennials, moving things around. It's actually still excellent weather for planting summer or winter cool season vegetables, all those flowering things like pansies, violas, snapdragon, stock, cyclamen, all those things that bloom through the winter and into the spring here. This is something that is new, so I always want to mention it at the start of the program. It's new to you if you move to this area from a colder climate. We actually have a full winter gardening season here. And so people are asking, they're walking in with little six packs of broccoli and saying, do I need to protect these? Do I need to be concerned about them? You need to protect them from animals and birds. You don't need to protect them from the weather. The temperatures are perfectly fine. Someone else asked me, do we get frost here? How cold does it get? Yes, we do get frost. We get on my farm 2 to 3 dozen visible frost every winter. We get down to 30 to 31 degrees a number of times during the course of the winter. In town, 28 degrees. I'm talking about Davis, but true for Sacramento, Dixon, Woodland, the whole area of sunset zones 8, 9, and 14. We do get down to 28 degrees, 29 degrees a few times during a typical winter. On my farm, we get to 27 degrees very regularly, which is cold enough to injure tender plants to damage summer annuals, but it doesn't do any harm to the things we started talking about at the top of the program, the vegetables and the flowers that we like for the cool season. We get down on our property out in the outlying area to 25 degrees almost every winter, but people in town rarely get that cold. There's a big difference when you're in an outlying area versus when you're in town. So we are more accustomed to maybe having to protect a young citrus tree that we've just planted, or a bougainvillea if you've just put something like that in. So we'll talk more about that as we get into colder weather, how to protect plants from frost. But the only things that I would think twice about planting now and maybe hold back on would be those subtropical things, the bougainvilleas, if you're going to be planting those here in our climate. Young citrus could be vulnerable to cold injury, so be prepared to protect them if you're putting them in now. Everything else, if it's a hardy plant, this is the time for planting. California native plants, perennials, flowers for winter and spring bloom, vegetables for the cool season vegetable garden, and so forth. And fruit trees are right around the corner. And I'll tell you what's really right around the corner. Lois, what do you think the most common question we're getting is at our garden center right now?
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
No. Let's substitute tomatoes for onions. We now have about 40 people to notify when the onions arrive. Every day, most of our questions are the onions in yet? Are the onions in yet? Are the onions in yet? Okay, folks, they'll
be. So, Don, when are the onions coming?
The first or second week of November. Okay.
So that's Saturday.
Yeah, that's what they heard. I said the first or second week of November, and they heard November 1. They'll be there right at 8 a.m. Amazing. Amazing to me. After all these years, it's still amazing to me how excited some people get about onions. Upcoming events. Let's see. The UC Davis Arboretum is having one more plant sale. Their clearance sale is on Saturday, November 16. November 16, that's 9 to 1 p.m. It is open to everyone. They call it their clearance sale, and I don't think they've posted the list of their inventory yet.
Over 2 weeks away.
They have the inventory from the last sale. It says right here, the lists have not been updated since our October 26th sale, but there will be a new revised inventory about a week before the November plant sale. Thousands and thousands of plants available, but this is their big clearance. So if you missed the last two, this is it. Let's talk about one of the programs here at KDRT. There's all kinds of amazing music programs here. And one of my favorites is Twang Thang, which I think is fun to say anyway. Twang Thang features outlaw country, old and new, showcasing the folks who sowed the harder-edged musical seeds for what we today call Americana, as well as the newer artists who continue the tunes and outlaw ethos forward. Twang Thang is live on Monday, 6 to 8 p.m., replays a couple times during the week. So for the rebroadcast time for that and all the other great programming here, and to add a little twang to your life, just check the schedule guide. We've got questions that have come in from you folks. And if you have those kinds of questions, you can send them to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. And what's the first one in front of you there?
It's from Gaina, and it says, as the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S. How does it pronounce that? Xerces?
Xerces is the way I say it. X-E-R-C. They're an advocacy group for pollinators.
Oh, I thought they were for dry gardens.
No, that would be Zurich.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. All right. Anyway, as they say, leave the leaves. Well, this brings me to a question. How many layers of leaves do you leave in your garden? Not all leaves biodegrade in 1 year. At times, the leaves seem to be smothering plants. I assume you can remove leaves on plants, but keep leaves around the plants. Is there a point where bacteria or other wanted organisms are building up because of the layer of piles of leaves on the ground? Thanks in advance for your always helpful advice.
The leaves are great. Yes, leaving them is wonderful. How long can you leave them? If it was addressed to me, I allowed leaves from my giant London plane tree. Most of us here in California call that a sycamore, but it's the enormous London plane tree. I left them under that tree for more than 20 years, letting them pile up more and more and more, raking them off my driveway and just continuing to pile them up under the plants that were there. I should note, most of the plants that they were around were woody plants, shrubs, or at least larger perennials that are more than, say, 12 inches tall. It is correct, especially with leaves like those from sycamores and plane trees and mulberries and these larger, heavier, more leathery textured leaves, but they could potentially, at least in theory, smother some small perennials that are down there that just can't push through them. It hasn't been my experience.
Or weeds, Don.
Well, yes. And so they smother weeds, but they also, there's always the one that makes it through and then has the whole place to itself. So they have advantages. Yes, you can smother weeds and you can move them around. The first house we lived in, we had two fruitless mulberries out front. It had no air conditioning and it had no insulation. So we treasured those mulberries. Let me tell you, they made about a 20 to 25 degree temperature difference in the house. And we pruned them open. We correctly trained them so that they were reaching their full potential. They're really quite impressive trees. Still, they're still there. Instead of hating them back as you see people do. Let me tell you what comes down from two fruitless mulberries. It's about a 2 foot deep pile of leaves right under those trees. And nothing will grow through that if you leave it all right there. You're not going to have a lawn. You're not going to have ground cover. So we would rake those leaves up and we would carry them to the backyard and spread them out wherever we were planting winter vegetables or planting no vegetables but had summer vegetables. And we would just mulch the whole zone with them. If there was broccoli or something, to gain his point, we would pull the leaves away so they weren't burying the broccoli plants because little annuals and little perennials could get engulfed in the leaves. Even those heavy textured leaves with a normal rainfall season would pretty well disintegrate by the time it was time to plant our summer garden. So my experience, even with heavy textured leaves, is they will break down when we have anything approaching normal rainfall. During the droughts, and we've had two major droughts in the last 15 years, they'd just be lying there in the spring. I mean, only half of them would have disintegrated. So moisture was certainly a factor in that. To the question, there's nothing, no such thing as too deep. It doesn't hurt the soil in any way because even leaves are relatively coarse textured. And we get back to the point often made by Dr. Linda Chalker Scott up there at Washington State University. If you're mulching with geometric mulch, her term, chunky stuff, stuff with air gaps in it, you're not going to smother plants. You're not going to harm woody plants. The only thing you would smother is something that simply can't push through that within one growing season. It's not a problem to have 12 inches deep, 18 inches deep of leaves if you want to. As long as they get some moisture during the winter, they will start to break down. And most plants, in my experience, will push through them. But if it's a delicate little perennial or something that you're, you know, a cyclamen, it would take a long time for that poor little guy to get through the leaves. So what we would do where we left them in places where we had desirable plants is we'd rake them carefully to the bare areas under the woody plants, the shrubs and such, let them be as deep as they wanted to be there. And then we would pull them away from rosette forming plants or plants that simply wouldn't be able to push through, and especially things that are blooming in the winter, such as hellebores or cyclamen, things like that. So you want to pull them away from those. But there's no problem with large amounts of leaves. I know there are people who have issues with the appearance, you know, that their homeowners association may send them stiffly worded letters if they're allowing leaves to pile up on part of their property. But you can take them in the backyard. At least your HOA doesn't care what's going on back there. Or you can do what one of our listeners sent us some pictures of. You can mow them down into little bits and then rake them back into wherever they were falling. And that takes away that cosmetic issue and it actually hastens the breakdown. It was our longtime listener in Southern California who's a commercial landscaper and gardener who sent us pictures, and I'll see if I can find those, where you would rake them onto the driveway, mow them on the driveway to just break them down, and then rake them back onto the lawn or whatever ground cover. And most ground covers and most turf, a thin layer of leaves being raked over, and then another layer and another layer will not harm them. It's actually beneficial to the soil, beneficial to the plants, and takes care of that cosmetic issue if you happen to be in a place where they're going to get mad at you for having leaves on the ground.
Okay, so one of the things that we would normally talk about is having bulbs and things that are down for the winter and then come up in the spring. So here's another place where having some nice little ornamental sticks on either end of the row of bulbs so that you can see them.
You remember can tell where, they are.
Remember where they are. And then you can carefully pull the leaves away if you need to. Though I got to say, unless your leaves are a foot deep, most bulbs will come up right through them.
Right, bulbs will push through. Anything that has a growth habit where it pushes up in that way, like a grassy leaf, can just push right through. It can even push through arborist wood chips. So these are things that can get their way up into the sunlight and do what they need to do. But one of the most successful plantings we ever had under those two fruitless mulberries was bulbs. One year I planted at least 100, I think it was 200 red tulip bulbs in a whole long border under fruitless mulberries. And you think, oh, that's too much shade. Well, their entire life cycle was in the sunny part of the mulberry life cycle. In other words, it had dropped its leaves and sun was coming through. Now, admittedly, tulips here usually don't come back. So that was a one and done kind of thing. But we had lots of daffodils out there. And daffodils and narcissus and freesias and any of a number of other spring flowering, fall planted bulbs are just fine in the shade of deciduous trees. In fact, that's where many of them would naturally be because their whole life cycle, they come up here in the winter, they grow out as they're blooming, they finish blooming in the spring as the tree is leafing out. So they get enough sunlight to not just persist, but multiply. So bulbs are a good possibility for those of you trying to figure out some color for the shade. That'll be a topic a little bit later in either this program or another program. How do you get color and pretty plants in the shade? But in terms of leaving the leaves, it's okay to leave them. And even big, heavy leaves will typically break down. As I say, if we have a drought year, rake them into piles and water them a little bit. I mean, that'll get the process going because we had a year during the second drought of the last 15 years where we didn't get a single rainstorm in the month of January.
Let's talk about shade. And a listener wrote in, and we'll do this one in depth later, not today, because he was telling us about this plant that we need to do a little research on because Don doesn't know this plant.
That's I don't know how it does here. That's, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things he said is, I've learned that the term, quote, shade plant, unquote, means considerably different things to different horticultural organizations, depending on their perspective. This plant is endemic to New Zealand, where it apparently seeks more shade than it does in Great Britain, where the Royal Horticultural Society said it can take full sun, but that is British full sun.
Yes, their sun is very different than ours.
So he's provided links and everything. And we'll come back to talking about this particular plant. But I want to talk today about shade.
Yeah, that sentence is really good because it is absolutely true. When someone will walk in and say, I have a shade area and I'm looking for some plant suggestions, really, we kind of have to ask a somewhat technical question. What type of shade? Is it like all shade all the time, you never see sun? Or is it shade filtered through a high tree? And yeah, sun in Great Britain, it's all the same planet. It's all the same star. But we get more of it here in the Sacramento Valley. In point of fact, and this is a funny data point, Sacramento metropolitan area is the sunniest place on the planet, June, July, and August, and September. Sunniest place on the planet. How can that possibly be? Well, two factors.
One, which means we don't have clouds.
Well, that's part of it. And we're very and pretty far north compared to the other places you would think of. So the higher latitude means we have longer days compared to, say, Arizona. And we don't have cloud cover pretty much at all during the summer here. The number of cloudy days in June, July, August is one or two at most. Sometimes we get an anomalous storm coming up from the Gulf and so forth. But typically we are sunny, sunny, sunny. Lois can start the program from about mid-April.
It's a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
And that's a fact. And also the intensity of our sun, you know, obviously the intensity of the sun in Arizona is greater. They just had an amazing summer in Phoenix where I don't even remember how many days over 100 they just had. And of course, that's temperature, not sun intensity, but it tells you something about what they're dealing with. Here we get, when we say full sun, if I have a plant that's in full sun, it's from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. in the summer, and it may be a 105-degree day. So that's a little different than full sun in Great Britain or New Zealand. We want to know if you have a shade area. What causes the shade?
Well, the real key is it complete shade? Most people, when they say total shade, they don't mean complete shade with not a speck of sun ever. Anytime, year round, summer or winter. The only place you're going to find that is if you've got a house and this plant is on the north side of it.
Well, there are houses in Davis that are a particular architectural style. string houses that were built by a particular developer, and they followed the kind of the roofline model of Frank Lloyd Wright. So long, slightly sloping rooflines. And that's great. It can make really cool patio areas to sit. But unfortunately, in some cases, they put planter beds under those roofs that extend way out from the house. If it happens to extend out to the south, okay, pretty good news. You've got some sun poking in there in the wintertime as the sun drops down further in the sky. And if you're really lucky, they cut a little gap out of the roof and made it so that sun would come down onto your planter bed. The flip side of that is the ones facing north, under an overhang. So no direct sun ever. No skylight or anything in there, and even worse, no rainfall because the roof line is completely shading that bed. The list of plants that'll grow there is about five things.
And there's a house on each side of this place. It's like a little walkway into the entry,
Right.
and it's maybe 20 feet long with planter beds on both sides and a house on each side. There's absolutely no way you're going to get sun in there unless you put in a mirror system. I
Yeah.
saw that one house, and they had, no, seriously, they had put mirrors to try and get a little bit of light in there.
Or you can cut in and you can put the equivalent of a skylight in there. Now, there are a handful of, we've helped people with these. So if you happen to have this situation of a shaded garden bed that never sees even bright light, Sarcococca is a shrub that'll work in that situation. The ruscus or butcher's broom is a perennial that has a really interesting foliage, and it's very, very, very tolerant of low light. Aspidistra, the cast iron plant, is the name is appropriate. It will grow in very low light conditions. Turf lily, folks in the southeastern United States know that one real well. It's very popular down there, and it grows very well here in California. Liriope or liriope, however you prefer to pronounce it. And there's a bunch of them, and some of them actually bloom with reasonably pretty flowers. Mondo grass, that's what I planted under those fruitless mulberries at that first house, and it grew under fruitless mulberries, not much wood. So there are some plants, and you could try hellebores, you can try seasonal annual plants. I mean, cyclamen, we talk about being perennial, but it would probably bloom in there. Color is going to be a challenge. So you're looking more for interesting foliage.
For ground cover, so you've got baby's tears.
If you want to do the moisture, sure, but it needs constant moisture. It's not drought
What about dichondra? Is that would that take the total shade?
resistant. And also I'm reluctant to recommend dichondra here in Northern California because it is cold sensitive and also prone to a couple of problems. If it happens to come up in the shade, let it grow. Great plant for that. But it also tends to die out fairly abruptly. But there is a ground cover that looks kind of like it that will grow in shade, and that's Viola. Heteraceae, the Australian violet, which is tolerant of shade. And there's a couple of other violas that are reasonably shade tolerant. So what you have to do, you have to experiment a little bit. One house, they actually used what we consider indoor plants, one of the dwarf Schefflera. And, the house provides frost protection, and that's a reasonably hardy indoor plant. It's one that can live on your porch. So they did very well with that one in that situation. I've actually seen philodendron, the big, bold, textured one, the philodendron saloon. Southern Californians know that as a great big outdoor plant. It grows fine here in Northern California. It's actually hardy down to the mid to upper 20s, and you wouldn't even get there in an area that's under an overhang like that. So there's a big tropical leaf texture that you can get there, and colorful foliage in the summer of things like caladiums. It's the ones who want to fill it with bedding annuals. It's just not going to work. Impatiens won't get enough light to bloom in there. Even fibrous begonias probably won't get enough light to bloom in there in the summertime. So that part would be very challenging. So you look more for colorful foliage or textures.
Or wheels, Don. You could put wheels under a pot, have it out in
Nope.
front until it starts blooming, and then drag that thing in there. I mean, I do that with my iris. They're so bland and boring most of the year, and then they get this extremely gorgeous exotic flower, and it's like, oh, I want to see that flower. Well, I could cut it and bring it in the house, or I could just put the whole pot on a wheel and wheel it to the front when it's time for it to make its debut.
You could do temporary color, and that's and things like the cyclamen would be fine for that during the winter time, although they may not get enough light to keep initiating bloom. So it's a challenging environment. I've done very well with a particular fuchsia, the fuchsia triphylla, sometimes the variant sold as Gartenmeisterbonstedt. This is the firecracker fuchsia. It does great in more sun than people think. It does great in bright shade, but it also can grow and bloom in more shade. So it's worth a try. Clivias, for color are the one thing that if you're not too cold, if you're listening to us in zone USDA zone 10, 9B, slightly sheltered location, which you're typically planting them in because they prefer shade anyway. And keep that in mind. You know, the shade situation may provide frost protection, very likely will. Clivia or Clivia is the way the British pronounce it. It has a beautiful orange flower, and it does it only once a year, but the flower lasts for 4 or 5 weeks, and the foliage is bold and tropical looking. And so that's one that could give you some seasonal color. Beyond that, you're generally very limited for things that will bloom in that weird exposure. But that's not the only shade situation. That's just the most extreme shade situation. No sun at any time of year, and and very challenging for that reason.
You could do a hanging pot. Again, moving something that's blooming into the area.
I'm gonna say no. The reason I'm going to say no, and I basically stopped selling hanging things here in the second.
Oh, it's too dry, isn't it?
You'll have to water it every single day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hanging pots are fine, but we have to have this conversation. They walk in, they've moved here from, I don't know, someplace where it actually rains in the summer. looking for, where are your hanging baskets? And they said, well, the only things we put in hanging baskets here are succulents. I mean, we just don't really recommend trying other things unless you're never going to travel for even a weekend because they need water every single day. But if you're going to do that, the one that I'll suggest would be ivy geranium. It's reasonably shade tolerant, and it does bloom, and it can tolerate it if you go away for the weekend and let it go dry. All right. There's a lot of other.
If we're not in the total shade, like in next to a house, but we're in a shade that is deep shade, then the next question is it a deciduous tree?
Yeah.
Or is it a permanently shady spot? And so under my redwoods, they're tall, but they're not. And they're shady all the time, of course. It's an evergreen tree, but they're not total shade because the trunks go up a little bit, and then there's a little sun peeking in here and there, and stuff like that. So I would call that a full shade, whereas under my oak tree, it would be a summer shade.
Yeah, the oak trees, of course. Yeah, deciduous trees, you have sunlight typically in the wintertime, and the shrubs and such that will make some benefit from that. One of the reasons we want to know what causes the shade is that plants or trees that cause shade are an issue in and of themselves. Gardening under a redwood tree is very challenging. Coast redwood has roots that are quite aggressive. So in that instance, it's a fairly small list of plants that'll hold their own. What you need is plants that have sturdy, strong roots. You need, like I mentioned, the liriope or liriope. They have pretty thick, fleshy roots. The clivia, same thing. It has these strong roots. Asparagus ferns, if you've ever looked at their roots, they are tough, and they'll hold their own against the aggressive dominance of the coast redwood or the fruitless mulberry. And that, in fact, they did very well under the fruitless mulberry for me. I'll mention two that are very popular. Nandina, the heavenly bamboo, has rhizome-like roots, so it holds its own. And if you want a plant that's similar to that, that's native, the mahonias, the mahonia aquifolia, mahonia aquifolium compacta, and the non-native mahonias such as mahonia lobaria folia, mahonia repens. They all have, if you look at their roots as you're planting them, thick, sturdy roots. They spread by short rhizomes, so they're going to compete well with the coast redwood or the fruitless mulberry and hold their own and generally thrive in that situation. So those have worked well for us under fruitless mulberry in my case, and actually coast redwood. I've done both of those as well.
Well, the coast redwood, I have two in my front yard. It's on the side of the yard between me and the neighbors. And the problem isn't that the roots are aggressive. It's that they're huge.
Yeah, that too.
And they take up a lot of room. So I was going to go and plant a rose in there. I couldn't get enough dirt to put the roots in. So what I have ended up doing is putting in things that are very small. Like I have a whole bunch of cyclamen in there. Now the cyclamen are not deep rooted. They're not big. They have a little, is it a bulblet that's on the ground there? Yep. It is a bulb. Okay. So I was able to find enough room between the redwood roots that I could put a little plant in there. And so that was my solution
That's what ends up happening, competing with the roots and just digging a hole. Now, first of all, it's okay to cut small roots on a big tree. Don't worry about that too much. If you're getting into a big root, you should probably check with an arborist because they actually have arborist society standards for how big a root you can cut and where on different species. But if you're just, you know, half inch roots, they're in your way, it's actually fine to cut them. But when we were planting, for example, under the fruitless mulberry trees, we were chiseling holes. We were shaping holes where we could and sticking things like mondo grass in those holes and then hand watering those or carefully nurturing them until we could tell they were established before we just figured they'd be on their own with the regular irrigation system. Because you do have that root competition from the bigger tree. Mulberry roots are very similar. They're just everywhere where you try to dig under the tree. Any of you dealing with privets or bay trees, you'll have the same situation. You just have to basically make a hole where you can. And so we found that we would make a hole, put in a hellebore, and hand water it for the first season pretty carefully, and that would establish it. Hellebore is a good example of one that actually grows and blooms in considerable shade and blooms in the mid to late winter here. So it turned out to be a very good choice in some of those situations. Then there are the plants that can spend their whole life in that duff and soil combination of the needles of the redwood, the leaves of whatever tree that's creating this unusual soil-like substance. And then there's the native soil below. And ferns are a very good example. I mean, I did very well with ferns for many years underneath, directly underneath two coast redwood trees. And some of them were native ferns like Woodwardia fimbriata. Others were East Coast natives like the ostrich fern, Matukia struthiopterus. Those both did very well for me. And they're actually still out there. They've just been slowly crowded out by other things. They did well as long as I made sure they got the watering they needed. Well, in the case of redwood, they need water too. So, you know, as I was watering the redwoods to give them what they needed, the ferns and the hellebores and the turf lilies basically got what they needed. Under a more drought-tolerant shade tree with aggressive roots, you'll probably have to create a zone where you're giving extra water. So if you're doing ferns or things like that, just plan on doing some hand watering or put in, as I did at one house, the original one we talked about with the mulberries, a separate little drip or spray system for that part of the garden, making sure that the trees are compatible with it. And I would run that every few days because that's what those flowers and ferns and things needed. But that wasn't enough to water the trees. So this is very important. It's okay to garden under these great big trees, but you're not watering the tree enough when you just water that little garden bed. So every now and then, as we always tell you, please give those trees their own deep soaking. But there's lots of things that will grow in the brighter shade. And you do have more choices for color. You also have lots of choices for foliage. And I would mention one design principle that someone said to me like 35 years ago, and I've kept this in mind. In shade gardens, you're generally looking down. In sunnier gardens, you're typically looking more up. So look at the way you walk through a botanical garden next time. It's a sunny area, your head is up and you're striding ahead and you're looking outward because there's nothing forcing your view down. In the shade, you have a canopy typically of high trees or you have some structure that's enclosing your view. And you watch people walking out of the sun into a shade garden, watch how they're looking at things and their heads start going down and they're looking more at the shrubs and the ground cover plants. So you really can focus on groupings of plants at ground level that give interesting texture and color. A good example right now under my sycamore tree is my foxtail asparagus fern, Asparagus Meyeri. Right nearby, I still have that chartreuse sweet potato vine that everybody's enjoying so much. The caladiums, well, they're looking rough now, but they were looking really good just a few weeks ago. And these are all down either in pots or at eye level. And I have an agave attenuata. I mean, things with bold textured foliage down at ground level, which are way more effective in a shade garden than they are in sunny gardens where you tend to just be looking more towards the horizon. This was something that was pointed out to me by a designer. And I've watched this as you watch people walk through the arboretum or places like that. They walk out into the oak grove and they're looking at the expanse and the turf and the trees. They turn around, they walk back into the gazebo, and they're looking down at the plants at the ground level. So keep that in mind. If you are only able to garden in the shade, you do have this opportunity of cute little arrangements of plants with textures and foliage that will be functioning like flowering plants in terms of interest to the gardener, but you group them very aesthetically, almost like an arrangement. You aren't as focused on the expansion and the horizon as you are when you're looking in a sunnier garden.
Well, yeah. Of course, if you're in the gazebo, there isn't anything else to look at. I mean, you could admire the structure of the gazebo, but
if you step right outside it, and there's all the garden beds around the gazebo, which are shaded by great big trees that are out there. So, yeah.
And the other thing is, Well, when you go from the sun to the shade, I don't know about you, but I'm going to be looking at my feet to make sure I know where I'm walking.
Yeah, well, that's always a good plan. Yes. So I've mentioned some ferns. I'm going to mention just a couple of ferns because this comes up. The ferns, really? Are they drought tolerant? Well, there are ferns that are drought tolerant with respect to ferns. In other words, there are some ferns that are more drought tolerant than others. So maidenhair fern is not drought tolerant, but it does very well in the shade here in the Sacramento Valley, as long as you give it plenty of water. But Polistica munitum, the western sword fern, is a native, coastal native, but native fern here in California, which I have found can be watered just like a normal plant. It doesn't need any special attention, and it can go a little dry between waterings. Woodwardia fimbriata, the giant chain fern, which in coastal areas gets 4 to 5 feet. Here, it typically seems to top out about 3 to 4 feet. It can take sun, surprisingly. It also can take shade, and it can take drought. And then there's a couple of non-native ones like the autumn fern, Dryopteris, the other sword fern, the southern sword fern, which can run all over your garden. Be careful where you plant that one. That's Nephrolepis. And there's some others. The leatherleaf fern is a very well-mannered little fern that can take a surprising amount of drought. The worst thing that I do collect ferns, and the worst thing that can happen if they go dry is the fronds look rough. They look burnt. They look kind of withered. You water them, they'll push right back up. New fronds will come up from the rhizome. So what I've taken to doing, since I do like to collect ferns and grow them in containers, is in the summer, they're just sitting kind of like Lois's irises. They're shoved around in a corner where they get watered more or less automatically, and they look pretty good during the summer. As soon as we get some rain, they flush out some new fronds. I pull those containers forward, stick a few cyclamen in with them, and you have a winter display, and they look great all the way till about April. At that point, if a dry wind comes along, or you let them dry out and the foliage starts to burn a little bit, shove them back in the corner, make sure they get watered more or less automatically. Ferns love our winter here, and many types, such as the ones I just mentioned, are actually reasonably tolerant of going dry as well. They'll recover from drought, and some of them actually don't look that bad if you keep them on the dry side.
I want to say that the bulbs that he has listed here are all C bulbs. That's caladium,
Yeah.
colocasia, and two different kinds of cyclamen.
Yeah, cyclamen.
And certainly other bulbs, but those four are really good for the shade.
Yeah, caladiums are something you plant each summer. It's very hard to get the bulbs through the winter, even when you dig them and store them, but they're inexpensive. So you just buy new ones about May, and they give you those big speckled and bright pink and red leaves all through the summertime, and just plant new ones. Treat them as annuals. Colocasia is elephant's ear, and there's been a whole lot of new fascinating varieties introduced with variegated foliage or purplish leaves and so forth. They get big. They're very dramatic looking plants, which die down completely in the winter, but they do typically come back in our climate. And then we mentioned cyclamen, but I'll tell you, I've also done very well with wood hyacinth, which used to be sold as Scylla, Scilla. Now it is sold under the taxonomists have decided its official name is Hyacinthoides. Because that means, oides means like, so means like a hyacinth. Okay, so wood hyacinth, Spanish bluebell, there's a couple of different species in that group. They have multiplied quite freely under my Japanese maple, and they never get any sun, and they do very well. Those plants have been in the ground since my daughter stuck them in over 30 years ago. And the other one that's done very well is snowflake, which is Leucojum. Looks a lot like snowdrops, which you in colder climates would use. Snowflake, I have a little stand of it. Likewise, my kid planted one bulb when she was maybe 5. 30 plus years later, I now have a stand of about 25 plants in that spot that bloom every spring. Remind me of her amusing habit of going out and planting flower bulbs in random places on the property. That's done very, very well. And literally more than 3 decades old, absolutely for sure, because I know when it was planted. So there are some bulbs that will increase and bloom nicely in the shade. Grape hyacinth is another one. And be aware, with both of the hyacinthoides that I mentioned and grape hyacinths, they will reseed and multiply from bulbs to the point of increasing freely in your garden. The term we use in the nursery biz is naturalize readily. The term the English uses, they can be garden thugs. They are very adaptable plants, and they're tolerant of shade. So there are some flower bulbs planted in the fall that grow and bloom just fine without any direct sun, really, at any time of year. Not very many, daffodils and true regular tulips. No, this isn't the place they want to be. But some of what they call in the business the minor bulbs, these smaller ones or these, less well-known ones, can actually be very good choices for part shade or even considerable shade.
So you haven't mentioned a couple that I have in my yard. One is the Ryves viburnifolium,
Sure.
and that is the evergreen Ryves, Ryves being the currant and gooseberry family. And it works. It's beautiful. It is not a ground cover, but it gets up each, it'll
It
throw
is,
up
it is
and then
kind of.
it folds over until it's about ankle high. You can't walk through it because you'd trip,
No, but
but
it's a
it's
category of
beautiful.
plants we should mention. It is a ground covering shrub. It's an outward spreading horizontal growing shrub. Ryves viburnifolium, much like Euonymus fortunii, some of the ceanothus. These are plants that some of the Bakris, the coyote bush. These are plants that spread rather than growing upright. And so they'll get a foot and a half deep. So yeah, you're not going to walk across it like a lawn, but you can cover an area with it quite readily. And a single plant of Ryves viburnifolium on my property here that's been in the ground for 30 plus years is more than 6 feet across. And I don't even irrigate it. I haven't watered that plant in decades, and it does just fine.
Well, one of the things that happens with it, and it is in a shady area, it's under redwoods, so it does get watered. And what happens with it is it'll sprout up a little stalk, and then it'll get heavy and it'll fall over. And where the stalk hits the ground, 2 or 3 feet away from the original plant, it roots, and now it's its own little plant, and it keeps going. And so over the years, it has colonized in that front yard. And if you don't want it, you simply cut it off and pull it out. It is not invasive,
Oh no, this is
but
not a problem
it
plant at all.
is a, and the one of wonderful things about it is you can plant that thing under a tree that has incredible litter problems, and you will never see a speck of litter. It just falls right through onto the ground below this thing. It's a beautiful. Anyway, so you didn't mention it, so I wanted to.
And there's actually, some of the shrubs that are actually pretty familiar. Okuba japonica, the gold dust plant, which has golden speckled leaves, so it gives you a little color in the shade. Japanese Aralia, Fatsia japonica. I have a plant of that in complete shade, and it grows every 5 or 6 years. It's gotten 7 or 8 feet tall, and then I cut it practically to the ground and let it restart that process. Big tropical looking thing, even though it's completely cold hardy here. Japanese Aralia, Fatsia japonica. Mentioned the philodendron. In the shade of my high sycamore tree or plane tree, I have used abutilon, which we talk about a lot here, and I have a number of different kinds of abutilon there. The more shade they're in, the more they stretch. Doesn't seem to inhibit their bloom, but they can become lankier, taller plants. And so people get concerned. What do I do? Prune it. Do whatever you want. You can't hurt them. And not in this climate. And also, if you're now thinking about abutilon, there are a lot of shorter types available. There's some very compact growing ones that I've come into the bedding plant industry is actually growing some of these little guys that only get like a foot and a half tall. So you'll see more of the compact abutilon in the future. They can also take considerable shade. I'm guessing if you read the label and it says 16 inches and you put it in total shade, it'll stretch to maybe 2 or 3 feet, but they still bloom. So this is one of the interesting things. It's one of the few plants that gives consistent season-long color in the shade. And so we talk about abutilon a lot because it's one of Lois's favorite plants, but it is something here, anywhere in California that you're not up at high elevation, something that will bloom essentially year-round, even tries to bloom in the winter when it can look a little rough, but definitely blooms spring, summer, fall. And you can prune them any way you want. If it's gotten too leggy or something, go ahead and cut it back as hard as you like. So that's one that is just a favorite of ours. Even though they can be kind of stretchy and sparse looking, the bloom is there. The hummingbirds absolutely love them.
So, going from the sublime to the ridiculous, let's talk about little tiny plants that grow in the shade from bulbs. And I'm talking about, well, that grass, that little sedge grass that is such a weed in our neighborhood.
Oh, okay. Let's be clear here. You are mentioning nut sedge, which is
Nut
probably one
sedge,
of the
yeah.
most troubling weeds in the world. Very difficult to get rid of, very persistent, multiplies freely, and so forth. But it's
You
related
don't have
to,
to
yeah,
get
I
rid of
did.
it.
I'm not encouraging people to leave nut sedge. However, getting rid of it is a challenge. So if it's there, maybe you can learn to live with it. And you can follow the old dictum, it's only a weed if you don't want it there. So now it's not a weed if you've declared that you want it there. There are related plants sedges, actual sedges, carex, and some of the others, which will grow in the shade. So if you like that kind of grassy look, there are interesting carex and interesting other similar types of plants. I've got landscapers in town who are using dianellas and lomandras. These are kind of new in the trade. I think of them as sun loving, but they are reasonably shade tolerant as well. And these are what in the design trade they call accent plants. You're looking for a grassy leaf or a texture with a blade rather than a more typical leaf, because they make great contrast with other things. The turf lilies that we've mentioned a couple times have always been very popular for that reason. But some of the sedges and some of these things that are like sedges, most of the ornamental grasses need full sun. The few exceptions like Japanese forest grass, the Hakana cloa, actually prefers shade. Most of the others need full sun to look good. They'll be okay in light shade, but there are grass-like plants, the sedges and reeds and things like that. And if you've got a container and you want a dramatic texture, put a horsetail in it. Just don't let it escape into your yard. So there are plants that give that look that are quite shade tolerant. It's not that difficult to get that kind of accent and contrast.
So Don, you've mentioned dozens of plants in this section that we've been talking about, and people are going to have a hard time writing that fast.
Yeah.
I encourage everyone to come back to kdrt.org and look for our show, and you can re-listen to any show we've ever done. Or if you want to, you can go to DavisGardenShow.com and listen to the ones from this year. I'll be getting the other ones up again later. But is there a thing? I know you sent me a table. Is there a table on your website of the shade plants?
There are all kinds of articles that I've written, and there are tables and things. The simplest thing to do is go to redwoodbarn.com, and there's a little Google search box right there that searches just the website, and just type shade into it. So I'm going to mention two plants that people in other parts of the country probably know better than we do, although they do work here. One is Pachysandra. It's sometimes called Japanese spurge. That's not a great common name. We shouldn't call things spurge if we're going to try to sell them to the public, because there are a lot of weeds that have that name. But Pachysandra is a ground cover that grows in the shade of high trees and does very, very well. So that's just not real common out here. It's not as drought tolerant as other ground covers, but it is something that does work in the shade. And there's actually a variegated version as well as a green version. And the other one that I was going to mention is hostas or hostas, and they are very popular back east, and they do grow here. However, snails love them. Okay, we have the
French, we have snails.
Yes, we have the French garden snail, or French eating snail, is the way it was actually introduced into California intentionally, believe it or not, for food. It is one of our most persistent and discouraging garden pests, particularly for coastal listeners. When I was gardening in the coast of San Diego, garden snails were a year-round problem for me. And if they liked a plant, you just weren't going to plant it after a while, unless you were willing to like saturate your garden with snail bait. So hostas are very popular with snails. They do very well here. And I sell them. I have customers who grow them. And I'll tell you a little secret about them that I learned from a guy who was a landscaper in this area who collected them. He had something like 300 hostas in his expansive property out west of town. He made sure there were gaps between them. So each variety that he would plant, he'd give it about 3 feet of space, and there's open space between the plants, and he mulched heavily with bark and things like that between them, and he didn't have a solid bed of them ever. And if snails got in, they got into one area, they'd start breeding there. He would use the bait, the snail baits, whatever we were using at the time. Sluggo is the most popular version now because it's very, very low toxicity, right where he had the problem. He might even cut them back to go in and find the ones that were in there and get rid of them. So it didn't become a massive breeding ground for snails. Keeping them separated made a big difference. And I remember pictures of not only his, but other hosta collections that I've seen. So when I'm working them into people's landscapes, because they particularly want them, the reason they want them is the colorful foliage and the kind of the tropical look, variegated leaves. Some of them have very pretty flowers, and the fact that they're very easy to grow. I'll do a group of two or three, then a long space, another group of two or three, and so forth. Not a solid border of them, so that if they do get a snail problem, they can use a very small amount of bait and it won't quickly spread to become a snail breeding colony. The hostas are very popular in places where the garden snail is not a problem, and they do very well here as long as they're watered regularly and, of course, no direct sun.
Okay, so I have a snail solution. I'm not sure it's going to work, but I have one. I don't know if you know, but snails and slugs crawl around on that slimy foot thing that they have,
Yes.
and they don't like copper. So if you could put a copper strip on around a planter or around a pot or on something like that, then the snails couldn't get across it. Is that still true, Don?
Yeah, it's hard to get those things, but it was discovered that they won't crawl across copper barriers.
So here's my thought. I'm going to plant a hosta. So I take a 1 gallon pot and I cut it in half as I take in the bottom off. And then I put it down and I put soil and I plant the hosta in it. So now the hosta's planted, its roots are in the ground, but it's got this collar of plastic around it. And I can just put a copper tape around that, and that would stop the snails as long as the hosta isn't touching anything. What do you think?
It sounds tedious, but give it a try. Let us know how it works.
I don't plan to do hostas, but if someone out there does have hostas, would you try that?
Yeah, see try copper and let us know. The baits that are used for snails nowadays are iron phosphate, so they break down into fertilizer, basically. They're not completely non-toxic. If you've got a small dog following you around eating sluggo pellets, you definitely could have a problem. But they're not like the old baits, which were metaldehyde-based and caused lots of pet poisonings. So Sluggo and Sluggo Plus are products that are out there, and similar products that do work. Generally, we would just suggest don't create breeding colony sites. I mean, agapanthus, you get a big bed of agapanthus, you're going to have an ongoing snail problem. If you have that, then if you're using bait, put it over there. That's where they're coming from at night. They need a moist surface to crawl across. Moving here to the valley, I quickly found snails were seasonal here. They're not seasonal in coastal San Diego. They're year round. But here, because we dry off, once we get below the dew point, or excuse me, above the dew point, and we don't have morning dew, snails are much less of a problem. Slugs are much less of a problem for us because they can't crawl across a dry surface. So you'll encounter many recommendations online, like putting out diatomaceous earth, which works just fine until it gets wet. You'll have suggestions about barrier plantings you can do, barrier surfaces like mulches that you can put on the ground. All of them work until they're damp, and then they don't work anymore. But again, spacing plants widely enough so you're not just creating this massive colony. The first garden I had a 10 by 10 bed of crinum lilies that my parents had planted. And they get 3 feet tall, and they're loose, they're fleshy, lush lilies that have these amazingly beautiful flowers. Once every year or two, I would take machetes, chop those
snail condos.
Take all of that leafy stuff and pile it up to compost, and there would be hundreds of snails on the ground, which I would then rake up and dispose of. The only really effective snail remedy we found in our garden was ducks, which absolutely love snails. So my parents would pay me a penny a snail. Penny a snail, hand me a milk carton. I'd fill up the milk carton. My mother estimated the number. She didn't count them. And we would then take them and throw them in the duck enclosure, and they love snails. Ducks in your garden are a bit more of a problem in many ways than snails. So keep that in mind. But if you happen to have ducks, they do love to eat snails.
So why do ants go up trees? Citrus trees has ants in it. And what should this person do about that?
Yeah, citrus trees with ants are almost always a situation where there's either aphid, scale, or something else up there. And in the case of citrus, it's usually scale insects. Basically, when I see ants going up into a tree, I know there's two reasons that they would be going up there. One is for extra floral nectaries. Those are not harmful. You look at any cherry tree, look at the leaf, at the base of the leaf, you'll see two little glands, and they'll be shiny. And if you touch that shiny stuff and touch it to your tongue, it's sugar. It's basically sugar solution. That is drawing them. It's trying to draw pollinators is the purpose of extra floral nectaries. They draw pollinators to the flower. Well, little thing exuding a little bit of sugar on the leaf is going to draw ants. So if you see some ants going up into the tree, But not a massive freeway of ants going up into the tree. Watch them, and they're probably going to extra floral nectaries, these little things at the base of the leaf or the base of the flower. More commonly, when ants are going up into a tree and you start seeing a busy roadway of them, and then pretty soon a highway, then pretty soon a super highway, they're going up there because there's an insect infestation in the tree that is exuding sugar, exuding honeydew. It's likely to be aphids, scale, or white flies. In the case of citrus, it's usually scale insects. So you need to control the thing that's feeding the ants. Killing the ants, well, you come up with a solution to that, you will be a billionaire. But if you find their food source, figure out what their food source is and deal with that, it'll probably take care of the ant problem. Yes, there are sprays that kill ants. And most of them are synthetic pyrethroid sprays. Most of them, like the Raid brand that you see literally at the grocery store, the hardware store, if you read the label, these are synthetic pyrethroids. And if your ants are in a place where you're not real concerned about using a pesticide, you can use them. They're very effective and you need to use very much. I mean, that's something you can explore on your own if you wish to. These have replaced the old materials, which were much, much, much more toxic and were much more harmful to the environment. But spraying the ants, there's going to be more. If there's a food source there, they're just going to keep coming. So you need to deal with the food source, which is probably scale in the case of citrus. How do I deal with scale on citrus? I go get my kid's pressure washer and I hook it up and I go to that tree and I go at that tree with all the vigor that that pressure washer will provide. And I find where the scale are if I possibly can. And I heavily blast the whatever is in there, typically scale, as I say, two different kinds, typically brown scale or sometimes cottony cushion scale. And you can literally obliterate them. I mean, if you do it with enough pressure, it will peel them off of the leaves, peel them off of the small twigs and bark. They can't get back up there. So that does work. Once you've done that, of course, you've blasted all the ants away at that time as well. You'll never get 100% of them on the first go around. So ants can be your indicator that the scale have come back. And that tells you that it's time to go get that pressure washer again and go after the tree. And if the tree is reasonably small, this is not a totally unreasonable proposition. You can get a nozzle that goes on your hose that does much the same thing. It doesn't have the force of a pressure washer, so I guarantee you'll have to redo it. But you can manage scale and aphid infestations, as we've told you many times on the show, just with a very vigorous blast of water. That will take care of the ant problem. So getting rid of what they're going for the food is really your best approach to dealing with ants.
So we always close the show with a gardening quote or meme or something. And here's my question. Was William Shakespeare a gardener? It really seems likely. Here are two quotes from a couple of plays. Sweet flowers are slow and weeds make haste. Mm. That sounds like a gardener to me.
Yes, I'd say.
And then and the other one, which this harks back to Don's advice on how to take out baby weeds. Now 'tis spring and weeds are shallow rooted. Suffer them now and they'll overgrow the garden.
Suffer them now and they'll overgrow the garden.
Allow them to live. Suffer them to live.
Yes, thank you for translating from Shakespeare. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.